seen at the house. The announcement elicited various mumbled comments and several grumbling ones, but in the face of Cecilia's grief, her guests refrained from making any more strident complaint.
"So can we go to our rooms, then?"
Melinda Boyne asked somewhat plaintively.
"Yes, indeed."
Sir Humphrey gave a short bow. "Thank you for your forbearance. I will return in the morning with the inspector, and we'll evaluate where we are then." The company didn't wait for further encouragement. Most rose and made for the door in twos and threes. Sir Humphrey walked to where Cecilia sat, exchanged a few quiet words, then, with a last general nod, headed for the door. Antonia looked at Sebastian. When he met her eyes, she murmured,
"We can't talk here. Let's go up."
Together, they rose and fell in behind Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon, who between them were supporting Cecilia upstairs. Considering Cecilia, considering the depth of shock he'd glimpsed in her eyes, Sebastian wondered if she'd known anything of Ennis's fears. He did not for a moment imagine she was in any way complicit in her husband's murder. Quite aside from her eminently sincere grief, he couldn't imagine that becoming a widow would ever have been part of the future Cecilia had planned. If he'd been asked, he would have said she'd enjoyed her life as it had been. She and Ennis had understood each other, and regardless of their dalliances, had got along well. He and Antonia left Mrs. McGibbon and Mrs. Parrish helping a wilting Cecilia into her room. The instant they'd passed under the archway and into the east wing, Antonia's fingers curled into his sleeve, and she tugged, then towed him up the corridor to her room. She opened the door. He glanced quickly down the corridor, confirming it was deserted, then followed her inside and shut the door behind him. Antonia lit the lamp that stood on a side table by the armchair near the fireplace. She adjusted the wick until the lamp shed a golden circle of light over the area before the hearth. Then she straightened and looked at Sebastian. He'd followed her and had halted before the hearth, and now stood gazing into the fire.
"What on earth did Ennis mean?" she asked. "Gunpowder here? Here? Where?"
Lit principally by the firelight, Sebastian's features appeared chiseled and harsh. His lips thinned.
"Precisely. Here meaning England, here meaning southeast England, including London, here meaning Kent, or this stretch of coast, or here meaning this estate, or even just the house."
She folded her arms and gripped her elbows. She felt chilled, as if the proximity of violent death had cast an icy pall over her.
"He could have meant any of those, as far as I can see."
She started to pace back and forth, a yard before the hearth and parallel to it, driven by restlessness more than anything else. Sebastian straightened his shoulders, then glanced at her and saw her pacing. He hesitated for a second, then turned and fell to pacing too. His longer strides carried him around her on a roughly oval track. She knew he paced when deep in thought. Fixing her gaze on the floor, she paced in more restrained fashion.
"Presumably, gunpowder here is the crux of the message Ennis intended to give Drake. If they, whoever they might be, have some gunpowder here, wherever here is, what are they planning to do with it?"
"Blow something up."
Sebastian paced on. "But what?"
"But that's a clue, isn't it?"
Antonia swung around and paced back.
"Who would think to gather gunpowder and blow something up?"
"Given Ennis's connections to the young islanders, I can't see the who being any other group."
"I thought the young islanders, those left after the rebellion was put down, were more peaceable these days."
"Those remaining in the public eye are, but no doubt There are more militant elements still skulking in the shadows.
So, if it is the young islanders, what would they be likely to want to blow up?
His gaze on the floor, he shook his head.
Most likely something in London. But it might be elsewhere. For instance, Windsor Castle.
The edge of her skirts flicked into his field of vision. Abruptly, he halted, just in time. With a suppressed squeak, she pulled up, less than an inch away. With a sliver of air, heated and heating, separating her breasts from his chest. She swayed with the suddenness of her halting, even as her head jerked up and her eyes met his. Wide grey eyes, roiling with surging heat, with passion, with desire, with hunger. In that instant, he saw it all, and was seized with a powerful, nearly overwhelming urge to reach out and take, to raise his hands, close them about her waist, and jerk her the last inch to him. And what then? His mind reeled. He felt himself teetering at a metaphorical fork in his path. This way or that? But the decision was irreversible. Antonia stared into pale green eyes, Warlock's eyes, with the power to mesmerize. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't think. But she could feel temptation, rich, alluring, compelling, slide across her skin. It whispered to her senses, stroked them beguilingly. Enticed her. Her lips felt fuller. The lower throbbed. As if he knew, his gaze fell to fasten on her mouth. For a second, they stood frozen. Then he hauled in a breath and stepped back. Without meeting her eyes, he turned to the door. We should sleep on our questions. The ones about you and me, or the ones about gunpowder? As he crossed to the door, she was tempted to ask. Once she was free of his immediate orbit, her wits functioned with their customary facility.
No doubt we'll see things in a clearer light come morning.
He paused at the door, his hand on the knob, and through the shadows looked back at her. Then he nodded, somewhat curtly, and went out. She watched the door quietly close behind him, then heard his footsteps, muted by the runner, continue down the corridor to his room. She discovered she could breathe again, although her lungs still felt constricted. Standing, staring at the space where he'd last been, she considered what her senses told her was the portent of that last, dark look of his. He'd been as tempted as she, but he'd set the personal aside and stepped back from taking the next obvious step in what seemed to be evolving between them, in favour of dealing with the mission. The mission that was increasingly looking as if it involved a threat to the realm. Gunpowder suggested a fairly major event and a significant target. She supposed she had to accept his decision as a sensible way forward. She rang for Becky and spent the next 20 minutes immersed in the commonplace, in the routine of preparing for bed. But once Becky had left, and she lay under the covers, shrouded in darkness, she finally allowed her mind to refocus on the evening's events. Sebastian had been right, but for her, clarity had already arrived. And courtesy of that, concern was slowly welling inside her. If Ennis had been killed in order to prevent him from speaking to Sebastian, then presumably the killer had guessed that Sebastian was Drake's surrogate, but the killer had fled before Ennis had died. What if the killer started to worry that despite being at death's door, before he'd died, Ennis had managed to pass his message on to Sebastian. Not just two words, but the whole message. Wouldn't the killer seek to kill Sebastian? Sebastian, who was being accommodated by Sir Humphrey and already being treated differently than the other guests. There was more than enough in the situation to make any killer nervous. Admittedly, Sebastian had let everyone else believe Ennis was already dead when he'd reached him, but being Drake's surrogate, he would have done that regardless. Such a pretense wouldn't protect him from a nervous killer. Should anything occur to delay me? Her eyes narrowed. Sebastian had suggested that the magistrate might detain him, but how likely was that? As he'd already demonstrated, he'd had no difficulty winning Sir Humphrey to his cause. No, he'd foreseen the possibility that the killer might come for him, and that was why he'd extracted that promise from her. Fierce determination rose within her, a compulsion powered by potent and forceful emotions. The feeling was so startlingly strong, it took her several moments to identify it. Protectiveness, but of a strain she'd never before experienced. Now she'd finally come to her senses and fully appreciated what Sebastian was to her. And it appeared he'd finally focused on her too. She was not going to allow any killer to get in the way of what she already considered their joint future. Of course, that future was still undecided, and might not come to be. But if so, it would be at their determination. She was not of a mind to allow any killer to interfere, much less dictate. She lay staring up at the ceiling, as possibilities and options revolved in her mind. As it happened, the best way forward was relatively easy to define. She would stick like glue to Sebastian's side through whatever investigative forays he made. That, she felt certain, as her lids fell and she slid towards slumber, was the only viable way of ensuring that the killer in their midst had no chance to derail the future she was now determined to explore. Chapter 6. The following morning, feeling decidedly grim, Sebastian walked along the gallery and started down the stairs. He'd spent far too many hours over the past night thinking of Antonia and that fraught moment in her room. If he had the time again, he was almost certain he would react differently, that he would give in to the urgent compulsion that had gripped him, if only to see where it led. Anything would be better, less aggravating, than all the hours he'd spent tossing in his bed. Yet despite the lust that hovered like a combustible cloud between them, a cloud he knew very well would grow only more dense, more intense, the longer they refrained from igniting it and letting it burn. Despite the fact that the scales had now fallen from his eyes regarding her, and if he was any judge, had fallen from her eyes regarding him as well, now was not the time to pursue such a connection. Not with a murderer under the same roof, and God alone knew what danger hovering. Gunpowder. Here. Ennis's words haunted him, constantly replaying in his mind. Duty and Drake's mission came first. Antonia and whatever might come of their new level of interaction could safely wait until later. That said, he'd already realized that he wouldn't be able to concentrate on the mission, on figuring out which, here, Ennis had meant, if he, the less civilized male inside him, wasn't assured of Antonia's safety. With a murderer in the company, the only way to ensure she was safe was to keep her with him. Given her typical feminine curiosity and her predilection for involving herself in whatever was going on, he felt confident keeping her by his side wouldn't require any great effort. Thus resolved, he stepped onto the tiles of the front hall, turned left, and entered the breakfast room. Somewhat to his surprise, he discovered he was the last of the company to approach the sideboard. Knowing that due to the distance from London, the inspector, and therefore Sir Humphrey, wasn't likely to arrive at the house until after 9 o'clock, he'd slept late. He'd thought others would have too, but one glance at the faces around the table suggested few had found any true rest. Most looked strained, but were endeavouring to rise above it. He was less surprised to find Cecilia at the table, nibbling a slice of toast and sipping tea. She'd never been a social hypocrite, and although she'd cared for Ennis, her feelings for him hadn't run deep enough to excuse any histrionics. She had endeavoured to find a black gown. The colour made her blonde paleness appear even more wan. After filling his plate from the silver serving dishes arranged along the sideboard, he carried the plate to the empty chair between Antonia and Filbury. Antonia welcomed him with a small smile, Filbury with a nod. As Sebastian sat, Antonia returned her attention to what he realized was a watchful examination of the others at the table. On his other side, Filbury leaned nearer and murmured, "Dashed awkward, if you ask me. I hope this inspector knows his place and allows us to leave. Seems pointless to keep us all here when it's plain as a pikestaff that some blighter climbed into the study, thinking to steal things. Ennis surprised him, and the blighter did for him. Wouldn't surprise me if there were gypsies camped nearby." Sebastian used a mouthful of food as an excuse to make no reply. Most were eating in silence, with only a few soft-voiced conversations among the ladies springing up and then quietly fading. As he ate, he studied the faces, as Antonia was doing. Cecilia was clearly saddened and sorrowful, but not distraught. Virtually everyone else looked unsettled and uncomfortable. None were sure how they should behave, and most showed signs of lingering shock and not a little uncertainty. A few of the men, like Filbury, were hovering on the brink of belligerence, but Sebastian judged that was nothing more than their way of dealing with a situation they didn't understand and couldn't control. He'd just pushed his empty plate away when sounds from the hall suggested Sir Humphrey had arrived. The company exchanged glances, very much of the "what do we do" variety. But before any answer was formulated, Sir Humphrey walked through the open doorway. A tall, thin, middle-aged man, garbed in a neat but undistinguished suit, accompanied the magistrate. The man, presumably the inspector, had a long, thin face and a long, thin nose, and his brown eyes were sharp and watchful. Both men halted just inside the room and waited for those about the table to turn and face them. Sir Humphrey greeted them all with a crisp nod and a brisk, "Good morning." He waved to the man beside him. "This is Inspector Crawford of Scotland Yard. He will henceforth be in charge of the investigation." Crawford stepped forward. "Lady Ennis." He half-bowed to Cecilia, then with a more general nod, let his gaze travel around the table. "Ladies and gentlemen, I understand you will wish to know how the investigation into Lord Ennis's murder stands, and I will endeavour to answer that question as soon as may be." The inspector had a dry, precise way of speaking that was curiously calming. "But first, I need to examine the study in which his lordship was killed. Subsequently, I will interview each of you, one by one, in the estate office. Purely routine. We need to determine where each of you were over the critical period, which I understand to be between 9:30 and 10 o'clock last evening. Until you are called to the estate office, I would ask you to remain in this room, the music room, or the drawing room. Once you've been interviewed, you will be free to move about the house and grounds, but at this stage, it's imperative that you all remain here, at this house. Several mouths opened, no doubt to protest, but before a word was uttered, Crawford smoothly rolled on. "Rest assured we will release you as soon as possible." He nodded to the company, a nod that was nicely gauged to be civil and appropriate, yet in no way servile. "Thank you for your forbearance. We will attempt to minimise the disruption to your day." With that, the inspector turned to Sir Humphrey, and together the pair walked out.
"Well," Mrs. McGibbons said. After a moment she added, "At least he seems a sensible enough person."
By which, Antonia Riley thought, returning her gaze to her teacup, "You mean the man was wise enough to appear conciliatory?" She'd been the second of the party to arrive in the breakfast room. Only Worthington had been before her. She'd sat toward one end of the table and had paid particular attention to the faces of all the men as they joined the gathering. She felt that a man who'd murdered his host the evening before should carry some sign of guilt in his countenance. Sadly for her theory, while all the men appeared sombre and even rather grim, none had looked remotely guilt-ridden. Several looked worried, even anxious, but more in the way of being concerned that they might be looked at askance by the other members of the company. All of the men seemed to have realized that suspicion might, at some point, focus on them, and they were all watching each other closely, searching, as she was, for some hint of who was the guilty party. No one stood out. There was nothing to distinguish one from the other. Now that the inspector had made his appearance, several members of the group eased back their chairs, preparing to rise. Before anyone did, Cecilia cleared her throat and raised her head. In a voice made husky and scratchy by weeping, she said,
"I fear I must apologize. Such a dreadful business to engulf us all."
Instantly, there was a chorus of disavowals and assurances that no one could possibly blame her, not at all. Cecilia smiled weakly.
"Thank you, my friends, not just for your understanding, but also your support."
She smiled at Mrs. Parrish and Mrs. McGibbon in particular. Seated beside Cecilia, Mrs. Parrish patted Cecilia's hand.
"There's no need to worry your head over us, my dear. I'm sure we'll all cope."
Several hear-hears supported that assertion.
"I'm sure that's so," Cecilia allowed. "But as the inspector has decreed that we are all to remain here for the time being, I wish to assure you that, while our planned excursions beyond the estate cannot now proceed, the amenities of the house and grounds will continue to be available for your use as previously. And while I'm sure you will understand if I retreat somewhat from your company, I would encourage you to make use of the avenues the house affords to divert your minds from this distressing situation."
Everyone, Antonia included, approved of their hostess's speech. In Antonia's opinion, it hit just the right note. Cecilia rose and excused herself. She dissuaded the other ladies from accompanying her, stating she intended to rest quietly in her room. Once she had left, pausing only to speak briefly with Blanchard in the doorway, the others of the company, apparently feeling rather better over disporting themselves while their host lay dead, started making plans for the day. On the ladies' part, the plans were restrained. But as Antonia listened, she realized that, as the shock wore off, the younger ladies, Melissa, Claire, Georgia, and Melinda Boyne and Amelie Billhurst, were rather titillated by the drama. None of them had known Ennis well, and his murder was, she supposed, more excitement than they'd previously encountered in their conventional lives. Most of the ladies had made some attempt to find dark colours to wear. Being black-haired, Antonia rarely wore darker hues, but she had brought a navy blue walking dress with her and had donned that this morning. Casting her gaze over the men of the company, she noted that, unlike the ladies, they seemed much more hesitant over committing themselves to any particular diversion in any other man's company. All appeared to be keeping their distance, mentally at least, from each other, even Mr. Parrish and Mr. McGibbon, who, if she'd understood correctly, were old friends. Before she could decide what the gentleman's behaviour meant, Blanchard materialised between her chair and Sebastian's. "My lord, Inspector Crawford and Sir Humphrey have requested your and Lady Antonia's presence. If you and her ladyship will follow me, I will show you to the estate office." An immediate and distinctly avid silence fell.
"Yes, of course."
Sebastian pushed back his chair and got to his feet. He waved the footman back and drew out Antonia's chair. She rose and smoothed down her skirts. She met Sebastian's gaze. He smiled faintly and offered his arm, and she placed her hand on his sleeve. Utterly ignoring all the fascinated watchers, Sebastian turned her toward the door.
"Lead on, Blanchard."
Leaving a pregnant silence reigning in the breakfast room, they followed Blanchard across the hall to the first door in the corridor, leading to Ennis's study. Blanchard opened the door and announced them. Sebastian steered Antonia before him into the office. It was a decent-sized room, with a large desk placed before the far wall, on which a detailed map of the estate was displayed. Pigeonholes and cabinets lined one side wall, with bookshelves covering the other. The shelves were packed with ledgers, all neatly arrayed, spine out. The room drew light from high windows in the wall it shared with the front hall, itself well supplied with natural light, courtesy of the cupola in its ceiling. The inspector and Sir Humphrey rose from chairs behind the large desk. The inspector nodded politely.
"Good morning, my lord, my lady."
He waved to two comfortable chairs angled before the polished expanse.
"If you would be seated."
He looked past them at the constable standing at his ease inside the door.
"Wait outside, please, constable, and make sure no one disturbs us."
"Yes, sir."
Sebastian guided Antonia to the chair on the right, then sat in the other chair, directly in front of the inspector. Antonia settled her skirts, then clasped her hands in her lap and fixed her grey gaze on the inspector, but said nothing. Sebastian took pity on the man.
"I take it Sir Humphrey has explained the background to my presence here."
"Indeed, my lord."
Crawford studied Sebastian for several seconds, then leaned forward, placing his forearms on the desk and clasping his hands. He fixed a level look on Sebastian's face.
"I'll be frank, my lord.
On the one hand, I'm not at all thrilled to discover that this murder might be connected with some political intrigue in which Whitehall's agents are involved. On the other hand, I have to admit to a certain curiosity. Not every murder has wider implications."
"I should think that was just as well, at least from your perspective. However, that is the hand fate has dealt us in this instance."
Sebastian hesitated, then said,
"It might help to mention that both myself and Lady Antonia are acquainted with your Chief Inspector Stokes, and even more with Mr. Barnaby Adair. We therefore appreciate the restrictions and requirements, and indeed, the limitations of your position."
Crawford pursed his lips, then his features relaxed somewhat, and he nodded.
"I believe we understand each other, my lord, my lady.
So if you would tell me all you know of Lord Ennis, up to the point of finding him dead." Antonia listened as Sebastian concisely explained what had brought him to Pressingstoke Hall, then described their arrival and the various events that had occurred since. He told of arranging to meet with Ennis at 10 o'clock and outlined his movements after the ladies had left the dining table to the moment of finding Ennis dying. When informed that Ennis hadn't yet been dead, and hearing Ennis's last words, Crawford widened his eyes. Gunpowder. And what did he mean by here?
Precisely our questions. With Ennis dead, we'll need to find the answers.
Sebastian glanced at Antonia, who had remained uncharacteristically silent throughout.
I suggested while you and Sir Humphrey search for Ennis's murderer, Lady Antonia and I should use the time to pursue the, as you labelled them, wider implications.
Crawford slowly nodded. Sir Humphrey mentioned some letters you hold. If I could see them, purely a formality. Sebastian gave him the letters. He kept them on him at all times. After perusing the second, Crawford glanced sharply at him. Why are you the last man Lord Ennis would want to see? Sebastian inwardly sighed and explained. He could almost see the obvious suspicion rise in Crawford's mind. But then the inspector glanced at Antonia, then looked at Sir Humphrey, both of whom appeared bored and transparently saw nothing of concern in a long-ago liaison. Sebastian sensed Crawford's bubble of suspicion deflating. With that issue dealt with, the inspector humphed, glanced at the letters again, then refolded both and handed them back. I agree that the best way forward is for us to work in parallel. It's entirely possible, even likely, that someone here, almost certainly one of the guests, learned that Ennis was about to reveal something of vital importance regarding their efforts to you, to Winchelsea, and so killed Ennis before he could.
Sebastian nodded. If I'd found him a minute later, the killer would have succeeded, and we wouldn't have learned anything.
Crawford regarded him with a level gaze. He might want to bear in mind that the killer might grow nervous over whether or not Ennis managed to say anything to you.
I took care to let everyone suppose that Ennis was already dead when I found him. At this point, only Sir Humphrey, you, and Lady Antonia.
Sebastian glanced briefly her way.
Know that he managed to utter even those two words. Two words that raise more questions than they answer.
The inspector nodded decisively. I'll leave you to pursue them. Meanwhile, Sir Humphrey and I will hunt our murderer.
I feel I should point out that, once you have him, Winchelsea and his masters will have a very real interest in interrogating him. They'll want to learn all they can, not just about the details of whatever plot's afoot, but about the organization behind it.
Crawford pulled a face.
We'll deal with Whitehall's interests once we have him. Meanwhile, he looked at Antonia.
If you would, my lady, could you describe where the ladies were during the half hour before the murder was discovered? Antonia repeated the information she'd given Sir Humphrey, adding that, in her opinion, Miss Billhurst was the definitive source on the ladies' movements.
She was at the piano the entire time, and had a clear view of the room and the door. Although she was playing most of the time, she's accomplished enough to have been observing her audience more or less constantly.
Crawford thanked her, then asked Sebastian to detail what he knew of when the other male guests left the dining room. Sebastian obliged. When he fell silent, Crawford looked over the notes he jotted down. So Ennis left the dining room first, followed a short time later by Mick Gibbon, Worthington, Filbury, Wilson, and Boyne. Exactly where they went, you can't say, but some, at least, said they were headed for the billiards room. A bit after that, you left and walked onto the front terrace, leaving Parrish and Fanshawe still seated at the table, talking. The inspector looked up and met Sebastian's eyes. Is that correct? Sebastian nodded.
And when I came in from the terrace a few minutes before the hour and walked to the study, I didn't see any of the others on the way.
Crawford humphed. I believe, he said, glancing at Antonia, that we can discount the ladies, at least for the role of murderer. He looked at Sebastian, then returned his gaze to Antonia. I have one more question for both of you. When the alarm was raised, did you see anyone, at all, whose reaction seemed odd or out of place? Did anyone behave in a way you wouldn't have expected? Antonia exchanged a glance with Sebastian, then looked at the inspector and shook her head.
No, I saw no one behaving in any way oddly.
Sebastian grimaced.
I didn't actually see any of the guests, just Blanchard and two footmen, all of whom were shocked and aghast, as one might expect. I didn't see anyone else until later, and by then everyone simply appeared shocked.
Crawford slowly nodded as he scribbled another note in his book. Then he looked up, his gaze once more sharp and incisive. I understand from Sir Humphrey that you wish to ride somewhere.
There's an old gentleman who, during autumn, usually rusticates nearby. He knows a great deal about politics and plots, and I'm hoping he might have some insight to offer into how best to respond to Ennis's warning. I also need to get a message to Whitehall regarding Ennis's death and his last words, preferably faster and with greater security than via the Royal Mail.
And this gentleman can arrange that? Crawford looked sceptical.
Sebastian smiled. If he's in residence.
He uncrossed his legs and rose.
I propose to ride out with Lady Antonia and find out. His house is quite close. We should be back for luncheon.
The inspector glanced at Sir Humphrey. Sir Humphrey nodded. Any help in this matter is to be welcomed. The magistrate got to his feet as Antonia rose. Crawford hurriedly stood and half bowed to her. Lady Antonia? Then he looked at Sebastian. If you learn anything that sheds light on who the murderer might be,
we will bring it to your attention without delay.
With a faintly ruthless smile curving his lips, Sebastian inclined his head to Crawford.
I hope you will reciprocate, should you discover anything pertinent to our interpretation of Ennis's last words.
Of course. Antonia saw Sebastian hold the inspector's gaze for a second. Then he stepped back and waved her to the door. She waited until they were sufficiently distant from the constable on duty outside the office before slanting a glance at Sebastian's face.
Where are we going, and who are we visiting?
He met her eyes. They'd reached the front hall. He halted before the stairs. She halted beside him and noted the way his gaze swept their surroundings before returning to her face.
Go and change, he said. I'll meet you at the stable.
She threw him a haughtily censorious look. Those words had sounded far too much like an autocratic command. But knowing his imperviousness on that front, without further ado, she went up the stairs. By the time Antonia had changed into her dark grey velvet riding habit, pulled on her boots, settled her riding cap at the correct angle on her piled hair, swiped up her gloves and crop, and started down the stairs, her mind had had time to sort through the morning's exchanges, and once again, concern floated at the forefront of her brain. Concern for Sebastian, that the fact he was being accorded special freedoms beyond that granted to other guests would mark him as in some way associated with the authorities, and he had been the one to find Ennis. Surely the murderer would be moved to wonder if Ennis, when found, had in fact been dead or still dying, still able to speak. She asked directions from a footman, then strode briskly out along the path to the stable. Sebastian was standing in the stable yard, the reins of a large grey hunter in his hand. A lighter-weight, leggy chestnut mare bearing a side saddle was tied to the railing nearby. Sebastian was chatting to the stable master, a grizzled older man with a knowledgeable eye. He smiled when he saw Antonia and dipped his head. Sebastian turned, his pale green gaze raked her. Good. He handed the grey's reins to the stable master. Antonia went to the side of the chestnut, intending to free the reins and walk the horse to the mounting block. But before she even touched the reins, Sebastian caught her about her waist, turned her, then lifted her to the saddle. She lost her breath. For a moment, she lost her wits and all ability to think. But the instant he released her, her wits returned in a rush. When he handed her the mare's reins, she narrowed her eyes on his faintly smug expression. Yes, he'd definitely done that on purpose, just to see what would happen. And he'd seen, and now knew. As she watched him stride to the grey, take the reins, then fluidly mount, she silently vowed revenge. He compounded his sins by arrogantly collecting her with a mere glance, then urging the grey into a trot. Counselling herself against acting precipitously, head high, she brought the chestnut alongside the grey and bided her time. Once they were out of sight of the stable, trotting briskly across the fields and angling toward the coast north of the estate, recalling her earlier worry, she called to him. "Don't you think us being allowed to ride out is going to mark you as working for the authorities?" He met her eyes. After a moment, he looked forward. "I'm my father's son. You're your father's daughter. We outrank all the others here by a country mile. No one's going to wonder over a police inspector allowing us to wander as we please. They'll just see it as proof that rank still wields power."
Ah.
She hadn't thought of it in those terms, but now he mentioned it. "Come on." He urged the grey into an easy gallop. "We need to find out if he's there." He who? And there where? But there was no point trying to converse at this speed. She thumped her heel against the chestnut's side and pushed the horse faster. Presumably, she would have her answers soon enough. The first answer, where they were going, came sooner than she'd expected. They'd veered to the coast and followed the bridle path along the top of the cliffs, but had gone only a few miles when she saw the uniquely curved walls of Walmer Castle ahead. Shaped like a four-leaved clover, the official residence of the Lord Warden of the Cinqueports was impossible to mistake, and that, of course, answered the question of whom they were hoping to speak with. As Sebastian led the way up the gravel drive, she shook her head.
"Wellington?"
Sebastian glanced back at her. "He comes down here every autumn. He may be nearly 80 years old, but he's still sharp as a tack, and he's still commander-in-chief of the army, and keeps his ear close to every political ground there is. If anyone can give us a rapid but accurate assessment of the potential of a gunpowder threat, it's him." They left their horses at the stable. The stable lad confirmed that the Lord Warden was, indeed, in residence. Side by side, Sebastian and Antonia strode along a hedge-lined walk to the drawbridge leading over the dry moat to an iron-studded double door made of ancient timbers inches thick. Sebastian tugged the bell chain. A minute later, one door was hauled open by a neat individual, who left them standing in the panelled entrance hall, while he took Sebastian's card to his master. Wellington's secretary soon appeared with the news that His Grace would be delighted to grant them an audience. Antonia hid a grin and followed the secretary, a dapper little man, along a corridor and up a curving stair to a large room in one of the towers. She'd met the Iron Duke several times, although not recently, but his acerbic wit and sharp tongue were legendary, and she remembered them very well. The long room into which they were shown was instantly identifiable as Wellington's own. A narrow camp bed rested against the wall farther down the room, and various mementos of his numerous victories were mounted on the walls or lay scattered here and there on side tables and chests. The great man himself was seated in a bath chair, a shawl draped over his knees. He still sat rigidly upright, and there was nothing whatever impaired about the mind behind his large, slightly protuberant eyes. As they entered, he set aside the clutch of papers he'd been perusing, and with a smile, waved them to the chaise at his left. With an answering smile, Antonia curtsied, then rose and went forward.
"My dear Antonia."
Wellington held out his hand, fingers waving for her to give him her hand.
"This is an unexpected pleasure."
Taking her fingers, he gallantly raised them to his lips, then gently squeezed them and released her.
"I hope you will forgive an old man for not rising. The manners are willing, but the flesh, I fear, has grown frail."
"Of course, Your Grace. I'm delighted you were able to receive us."
She glanced at Sebastian.
"I had no idea we would be calling on you, or I would have brought a gift."
"Ah."
Wellington's still incisive gaze shifted to Sebastian.
"Playing his cards close to his chest, is he? I wonder why."
Wellington's lips quirked as he held out a hand to Sebastian.
"Well, young pup, what can I do for you in your father's name?"
Sebastian smiled and shook the Duke's hand.
"Not in my father's name this time. As it happens, he doesn't yet know about this. I'm here, staying at Pressingstoke Hall, at Winchelsea's behest."
"Aha! Another of our more promising youngsters."
Folding his hands in his lap, Wellington waited until Sebastian settled on the chaise beside Antonia, then commanded,
"Start at the beginning, go through to the end, and don't leave anything out."
Sebastian complied. Wellington might be already at an age that, in others, would be regarded as their dotage, but there were few in England with a clearer grasp of all matters political and military, and Sebastian had enormous respect for the Duke's unique combination of experience and acuity. As if demonstrating that he hadn't lost any of his famed mental sharpness, Wellington posed several pertinent questions, pushing Sebastian to elaborate on his suspicions alongside his facts. He concluded his recitation of events with his and Antonia's recent meeting with Inspector Crawford and Sir Humphrey.
"The most urgent issue on my plate, as of this moment, is to get a letter to Whitehall detailing Ennis's warning, such as it is."
Wellington nodded.
"Yes, that must go, and with all speed. Winchelsea is unlikely to be back from Ireland, but regardless, the Home Secretary needs to know of this, early days though it is. One never knows with matters such as this what snippet of information will connect with another and give warning of something major. Have you written this missive yet?"
"Yes."
From his pocket, Sebastian drew the letter he'd prepared during the restless watches of the night.
"Good man."
Wellington pointed to the bell pull.
"Ring for Morton."
His secretary answered the summons, and after scrawling his name across one corner of the envelope, Wellington consigned the letter into Morton's care with explicit instructions it be sent off by courier immediately. When the door closed behind Morton, Wellington returned his attention to Sebastian.
"Now, as to this plot..."
Wellington paused. Then he sat back, once more folding his hands in his lap.
"What are your thoughts on it?"
Understanding that his grasp of the situation was about to be tested, Sebastian marshalled his wits.
The two words Ennis uttered, the way he said them, was distinct. The first word was gunpowder, and that itself was the point. It stood alone. To me, it seemed that Ennis saw the fact that gunpowder was involved was the most critical point he needed to convey.
Wellington nodded.
"Indeed. Impending death, I have often observed, sharpens the mind wonderfully. I believe you're correct in thinking that the involvement of gunpowder is of paramount significance."
"So what does that tell us?" Sebastian answered his own question. "That whatever is planned, it's deadly serious and likely to end in deaths. If gunpowder is involved in a secretive way, there really is no likelihood that the proposed use will be either innocent or minor."
"Precisely."
His gaze locked on Sebastian's face, Wellington continued.
"Ennis said gunpowder because he knew he hadn't time to say much more, and that single word establishes not just the substance, but also the seriousness of the threat he sought to expose."
Sebastian nodded.
"So to the second word, which, as I said, was separate. Here. Although distinct, I believe it was secondary to the first, that Ennis meant that the gunpowder was here, not that he intended to tell me something else about here, but ran out of time."
"But where is here?" Antonia asked. "There are so many possible interpretations."
Wellington inclined his head.
"I take your point. However, given this is gunpowder we're talking about, I believe your best option is to assume Ennis meant the specific, namely that he meant Pressingstoke Hall itself, and then, if there is no sign of it there, or of it ever having been there, extend your search outward to the immediate area."
He paused, then went on.
"Given Ennis was dying and knew it, we have to assume that his here means somewhere close, anywhere farther than the immediate neighbourhood, and I think he would have tried for another word."
After a moment, Sebastian said,
"That brings us to the next question, arising from Ennis's warning. Who is behind this?"
"Certainly the evidence points to the Young Irelanders, or at least their more militant fringe. However..."
Wellington paused, as if consulting his capacious memory. Eventually, his expression faintly puzzled. He continued,
"I have to say, it's not something I would have expected. The government came down hard on those involved in organizing the rebellion. And that was only 2 years ago. Takes time to regroup after a defeat like that. I wouldn't have anticipated any violent attack, much less one involving gunpowder, from that quarter so soon."
Wellington grimaced.
"However, with Winchelsea hearing rumours of a Young Irelander plot, and Ennis being Anglo-Irish, and possibly a sympathiser, as well as having other Anglo-Irish in the house, it's difficult not to make the obvious connection."
Wellington stared at the floor in front of his chair, then raised his head and frowned at Sebastian.
"I don't like wagering the nation's security on what might, in the end, be mere coincidence. We have precious few facts to draw on in terms of who might be behind this. For all we know, it could be the Chartists although, in their case, even more than the young islanders, we're dealing with a group who've been reduced to a vestige of their former strength.
And if it isn't either of those two groups?
Antonia asked.
Wellington snorted.
Then it could be anyone. Anyone with some wild idea of upending the government. Or indeed, the crown.
Several moments passed in silence as the great man cogitated. But then he looked at Sebastian and shook his head.
My advice, young Sinister, is to put aside the question of who is behind this action, and instead focus on what Ennis rightly identified as the item of critical importance, the gunpowder.
Sebastian held Wellington's gaze for an instant, then nodded.
Yes, that needs to be first in our order of battle.
Wellington grinned.
Your father always knew to keep his priorities in mind.
Wellington's expression grew distant. Then he refocused on Sebastian.
Ring for Morton again. There's something I should give you before you go.
Morton duly appeared, and Wellington demanded his writing desk. With it balanced on his knees, he swiftly wrote, then signed. After blotting the document, he handed it to Sebastian.
If you run into officious difficulties, just wave that in their faces. It should get you through.
Sebastian read the document and smiled.
Thank you.
He folded it carefully and tucked it away with the other letters he was carrying. Then he rose and looked at Wellington.
And thank you for your counsel, Your Grace.
Wellington wagged an admonitory finger at him. At them, as Antonia rose and joined Sebastian.
Don't get sidetracked. Locate that gunpowder. Once you do, how much of the stuff has been assembled will give you a clue as to the target. Once you have the target, you'll be several steps closer to identifying who the devil is behind this plot. Eliminate the danger first. Identify the target. Then go after the perpetrators.
They'd spent longer than they'd bargained for with Wellington. Consequently, they'd galloped most of the way back. It had been years since Antonia had enjoyed such an exhilarating run, with the fresh breeze off the sea rushing past her cheeks. After one brief assessing glance, much to her appreciative approval, Sebastian concentrated on nothing more than keeping his grey in the lead. He was only a yard ahead of her when they thundered onto the rear drive. Reluctantly, they drew rein, easing the horses to a trot, then a walk as they turned into the cobbled stable yard. The stable master saw them and sent grooms running to take their reins. With his usual fluid grace, Sebastian dismounted. Antonia slid her feet free of the stirrups, but before she could slide down, Sebastian reached her mount's side, and with his customary high-handed arrogance, reached up, closed his hands about her waist, and lifted her down. She'd been expecting him to do so, and had planned her revenge. She tipped forward as he lifted her. The shift in her weight had him taking a half-step back. Then he instinctively locked his legs and steadied. But by then, she'd placed herself in the same space, so close that he had to ease her down his body, more or less breast to chest. She thought she'd been prepared for the jolt to her senses. She'd been wrong. It was searing, like a sensual flame passing down the front of her, leaving an urgent longing to seek more of the contact, more of the heat, more of him, in its wake. Her heart raced, her lips throbbed. She felt warm all over and faintly giddy with wanting. But the effect on him, the tension that gripped him, was even more telling, more thrilling and enlightening.
She kept her eyes locked on his as she battled the urge to reach up and drag his lips down to hers, and let the thought shine in her eyes. His muscles locked, his features set like stone. He was waging a battle of his own. If they'd been anywhere more private, she might have added her weight against his good intentions. But instead, she found enough strength, enough determination, to shift one hand and pat his chest while she smiled into his sea-green eyes. His grip about her waist tightened. His jaw looked like it might crack. When he finally lowered her the last inch and her boots touched the cobbles, she made no effort to step back. Her message was simple. Two could play at this game. And she was only too willing to engage. Sebastian recognized a gauntlet when he saw one at his feet, but this was one challenge he'd elected to defer. The sane part of his mind reminded him of all the good, nay, excellent reasons why. The rest of his brain was urging him to pick up her gauntlet and counter, to riposte. This was the sort of game in which that other side of him delighted. The temptation to engage was well nigh overwhelming. But he had his own agenda, and had no intention of allowing her to divert him from it. The need for control, to remain in control, especially in this game, and even more especially with her, came to his rescue. With adamantine will, he set her down and stepped back, away. He ignored his howling demons, but the best retort he could muster, as he all but peeled his fingers from her waist, was, "We don't want to be late for luncheon." Her eyes widened. Then she looked down and obliged by turning toward the house. At least she didn't laugh. He swallowed his hunger and strode sedately, distinctly stiffly, beside her. After several paces, she glanced up at him. He didn't meet her gaze, but felt the quality of it. Pure female curiosity.
"I wanted you to kiss me, you know."
Damned impertinent and overbold female.
"I know."
His tone should have been enough to end that discussion, yet he was rather surprised when she didn't reply. They arrived at the side door. She paused, waiting as he reached out to open it. Before he did, her gaze once more on his face, she murmured,
"So what now?"
He faced her and narrowed his eyes on hers, deliberately ambiguous, or was she referring to both endeavors on which they were, apparently, now mutually engaged? He gripped the door handle, and reminding himself of the propensity of females in his and her family to act on their own initiative, repressively replied,
"Now we join the others for lunch, then check in with the inspector, and then we concentrate on locating the gunpowder."
Chapter 7. Antonia hurried upstairs to change out of her riding habit into a walking gown suitable for the afternoon.